From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, UFO disclosure. Will it happen? Here's what's happening. Adults who watch a lot of television may be at increased risk of dying at a relatively young age, according to a new study. Now, this study involved more than 13,000 adults in Spain who were all college graduates and were around 37 years old at the study's start. Participants were followed for about 8 years. There were 97 deaths there, and they blamed it on watching too much television. Interesting story from Google. They have unveiled plans for a new Android television at its annual developers conference, and the company also introduced Android Wear for smartwatches and Android Auto enhancements for cars. Google announced that Samsung would be joining the Android Wear family with a debut of the Samsung Gear Live smartwatch. The new operating platform for the smartwatches, which include smartphone compatibility. Now, when a user receives and gets a call, it will appear on the watch, and you'll have the option of sending a generic text to reply if you want. And what was widely expected is Android's television was revealed at the conference. This service works with the smart TVs, set-top boxes, and video game consoles, and allows users to watch movies and apps downloaded via the Google Play Store. Just amazing technology, isn't it? Reports that Syrian warplanes carried out a cross-border attack on Iraqi towns this week is further evidence of the blurring between the two countries' borders as they face an offensive by Islamic extremists. At least 57 Iraqi civilians were killed. More than 120 others were wounded by what local officials say were Syrian warplanes that struck several border areas. These border cities are among those under control of ISIS, which seeks to create an Islamic caliphate that encompasses portions of Iraq in Syria. And the Syrians don't want them there. And Iraq's prime minister has rejected calls for a national salvation government to help counter the offensive by the jihadist-led Sunni rebels. Such calls represent a coup, he says, against the Constitution and an attempt to end the democratic experience. Jerome Corsi from WorldNet Daily, a noted author with us. Jerry, we check in with you often on this Iraqi situation. It doesn't seem to be getting any better.
I think George, is really a mess. It's a civil war. It's really the Sunnis, which is the ISIS group, the terrorists, and the Shiite government of Iraq. And not only do you have Syria with trying to combine or attack the Sunnis in ISIS, but you've got the Kurds in the northern part of Iraq, who now about 6 million of them want to create their own state. So I think Iraq is in the process right now of disintegrating into three nations.
Jerry, and let me ask you this too with this situation. Now, the bombing by Syria, they were trying to take out the ISIS people. Some civilians got killed in that. But they seem to be getting involved in Iraq, and they want those jihadists out.
Well, Sunnis in Syria are aligned. The Assad government that controls Syria is aligned with Iran and with the Shiite government of Iraq. So they're attacking the ISIS terrorists who are trying to take over Iraq. It's really a Sunni versus Shiite war, and I think Iraq is going to very quickly disintegrate into three countries: Kurdistan in the north, the Shiites who control the government, and the Sunnis who control the south, which is also aligned with the Assad regime. The Shiites are aligned with the Assad regime in Syria. So it's very, very complicated. I mean, if you were, for instance, fighting for ISIS in Iraq, the United States government would consider you an enemy. But if you're fighting for ISIS in Syria, the United States government would consider you a friend.
Who's going to get the oil in Iraq, Jerry?
George, it's a very big question. Right now, there's something like 45 billion barrels, even in Kurdistan. And the problem for Americans is that this chaos in Iraq is likely to see a dramatic increase in oil prices very, very soon.
Sure is. Jerry, thank you so much. Jerry writes for WorldNet Daily. And in truth and fairness, activist and head of WND.com, Joseph Farah, said that his attempt to carry a loaded revolver through security checkpoints at the Dulles International Airport was a dumb mistake caused by a universal problem, lack of sleep. He said, there's no excuse for my mistake. 59-year-old, he wrote in his post at his blog at WorldNet Daily. In the interest of sympathy, however, I will add that I was stressed out. I did not sleep Saturday night, so I worked. I wrote several columns. I'd sleep on the plane to Seattle, where I was giving a speech on Monday. That's what I thought. Well, he was given a summons. The Supreme Court has ruled that police cannot search the digital contents of mobile phones of those arrested without a warrant. The unanimous decision is a win for privacy advocates that argued searching mobile phones was an unreasonable intrusion. Here's Catherine Albrecht, our privacy expert. I would guess that the Supreme Court did a good job today.
Hey, George, we're all celebrating here. I got to tell you, almost dancing in the streets. It's about time we got some good news from the government on privacy, especially after all we've found out that the NSA is up to. This is actually the second good news that we've had since 2012. That's when we got that good news GPS ruling that police could not stick a GPS tracking device on your car without a warrant. And now this one says if they pull you over or arrest you for really any reason, they can't just grab your phone and start poking through it. So this is really good news because for most of us, 90% of us here in America have a cell phone, and that cell phone is no longer just a phone, is it? It's really become kind of the repository for everything from photos to address books to you name it, it's all on there. And they recognize that and said, hey, if you want to go through it, you're going to have to go to a judge and get yourself a warrant.
Well, go celebrate, but before you do, tell us what you've been up to.
What have I been up to? Well, I am actually at an IEEE conference, a big engineering conference here in Boston, talking about Start Page, Start Mail, broadcasting my radio show live here and interviewing a whole bunch of engineers about the future of technology. And I'll tell you what I've learned would make your hair curl, neural implants, you name it.
The time has come. Catherine, thanks so much. Get some sleep out there. Antibiotic resistance has been selected as the focus for a $10 million prize set up to tackle major challenges of our time. The World Health Organization has warned of a post-antibiotic era where key drugs no longer work and people die from previously treatable infections. Can you believe it's been 5 years since Michael Jackson died? 5 years. Where does the time go? Michael Jackson died on June 25th, 2009, in a desperate search for sleep as he prepared for a comeback tour that he hoped would pull him out of a deep debt and restore his reputation as the world's top entertainer. Ironically, since his death, he's probably making more money now dead than he was alive. And a new study claims that the very warnings about suicide risks to teens taking antidepressants may have contributed to a surge in attempted suicides. The study, published in the journal BMJ, investigated the outcomes after the U.S. Food and Drug Administration began publicizing warnings of increased risk of suicide and antidepressant use in young people. The FDA warnings, which began in 2003, were specifically associated with changes in antidepressant use, suicide attempts, and completed suicides among adolescents. For the next couple hours, Dr. Peter Breggin joins us. He is the author of Medication Madness, The Role of Psychiatric Drugs in Cases of Violence, Suicide, and Crime. We'll get his take on this story when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Now, for the next couple hours, we're going to talk about something very serious, but also somewhat confusing. As we talk about this FDA study, this new study that claims, of course, that did suicide warnings about antidepressants trigger an increase in suicides? Now, they say that antidepressant use fell 31% among adolescents and 24% among young adults after these FDA warnings, according to the study. But suicide attempts increased by 22% among the adolescents and 33% among the young adults in the same time period. Why? Let's check in with Dr. Peter Breggin, of course, psychiatrist and author of several books, including Medication Madness. Peter, I'm confused. How about you?
Oh, no. It's the same old stuff, George. We have controlled clinical trials done by the FDA. This study was not done by the FDA. They supervised them. They reworked the analysis of them. It's very clear there's at least a doubling of suicidal behavior in children taking antidepressant drugs. That's as close as you'll get to facts. And when you look at the studies that were done for the FDA, they're so controlled that you're hardly going to get any suicidal behavior because the kids are being seen every week. They're being evaluated every week. The families are involved. They have a lot of hope. And they're only getting one drug, and they're being, you know, they're not taking the street drugs, presumably. They're not suicidal kids. So we've got the data. And it did cut back on, for at least a time, on the amount of prescribing to children, adolescents, and young adults. And that was a good thing. Now you've got this cockamamie study. It's one of many of these kinds of things.
It has, Peter. I got to tell you, it has confused so many people around the country. That's why it was so important to get you on to try to put this back in perspective.
Well, what can 18 professors produce when they're operating on behalf of drug companies? All they could come up with was, number one, most important finding, that there was no increase in the suicide rate, no increase in the completed suicide rate during this drop in the prescription of these drugs. So having found that data, which they didn't want to find, they came up with a secondary data, which is that psychotropic drug poisonings increased. Well, what are psychotropic drug poisonings? They don't even tell us. There's no specific percentage that we can say were actual suicide attempts out of this admittedly very small increase in psychotropic drug poisonings, which could mean emergency room visits for marijuana, emergency room visits for cocaine and heroin. So they just went and stretched. There's such desperation out there to keep our culture going down the pharmaceutical path. In addition, if you just look at the graphs, there was a big peak of suicidality increase a year or two before the warnings went in, when the drugs were rising in their usage. There's actually a brief drop during the year of the warnings in all the adverse effects. And then over a 2-3 year period, there is a rise in this poisoning, which we don't even know what it is. And there's no rise in adults who also had some reduction in the antidepressants. So it's just all made up. You know, 17, 18 desperate grown adults who should be protecting children instead of trying to contradict the very specific scientific data we have. And furthermore, George, you can see this gets me riled up.
No, I mean, no kidding.
It acts as if the only problem is suicidality with these drugs. You put children on these antidepressants, and their sexual development can be forever impaired. That's just what adolescent boys and girls need, is to become blunted sexually and then to discover in their 20s and 30s they don't have sexual feelings, which is happening to up to 90% of men on these drugs, and a big percentage of women, but they don't notice the physical effects as much. They're not talking about all the studies that show when you give these drugs to children, 40, 50, 60% of them get behavioral abnormalities like mania and a loss of self-control and aggression and irritability. These are terrible drugs. You know, on my own radio show today, it was just coincidentally, you know, I do a one-hour show once a week on Progressive Radio Network, and I had on a child psychiatrist from Australia, John Girardini, who long ago did a classically fine paper showing that antidepressants do far more harm than good in children, and that is still the case. We shouldn't be giving these drugs to children, but boy, they are big money makers, and they get papers published. All you have to do is hint that in some way we may have found something good, even, you know, that these antidepressants are preventing what? Psychotropic drug poisoning, which they don't even tell us exactly what it is, and having no effect at all in their data on actual suicide, completed suicides. It's just dreadful what's going on out there, George. The drug companies have transformed our culture into this fearful attitude toward life, where we need to drug our children for them to grow up. It's a bizarre situation. Absolutely.
The Sandy Hook, where the killer was Adam Lanza, a 20-year-old kid who apparently died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound there, killed 26 people at the school, then killed his mother. He apparently was on medication, Celexa, or something like that. I get two bizarre stories about this, Peter. One is he was on antidepressants and look what happened. And then there's a camp out there that says this entire Sandy Hook episode never occurred, that it was a hoax. And I got to tell you, I mean, I've not talked to any of the parents. I think I should, I guess, by this time. But how could people call this a hoax when 26 people died?
Well, you know, I think you'd know more about this than I, but don't a large percentage of Americans think we never landed on the moon?
Yeah, well,
so
they do.
I think what's happening is that people feel that the government manipulates us, and the government does. So when you get really frightened about being manipulated by big industry and by big government, then you begin to imagine all kinds of things didn't happen. I mean, one of the most interesting things to me about Sandy Hook was I got a call from an official in Connecticut, a high-ranking official. Can't tell you anything more than that, who wanted me to find out what drugs Adam Lanza was on, because with all his authority, he couldn't break through and find out what drugs he had been on or what might have showed up in an autopsy. That's the power of the drug industry.
True.
They had a... Yes. Yeah?
Well, you know, you're right. It is. I mean, he was very strange. I mean, he apparently changed his socks 20 times a day. Who does that, Peter? I mean, you're a psychiatrist. I mean, if you had someone that came to you and said, I've got a chronic compulsive disorder issue, I change my socks 20 times a day, what would you do?
Well, you know, I'd be really upset, but not as upset if his mother came in and told me that he was behaving really bizarrely, but she was buying him guns and going out and practicing with him.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're really looking at a bizarre family situation. You know, one of the things we're struggling with in this country is the extraordinarily high divorce rate, the lack of basic family values. You know, I'm so old that when I was in high school, we only knew one divorced kid in our class of about 130.
I know. In those days, people stayed married. I mean,
Now, maybe it wasn't always the best thing, and I'm afraid I was an advocate of, well, you know, just staying together to, you know, you shouldn't just stay together.
I think kids see that, though. I think they see the unhappiness in a family. I think it's probably just as bad. I think there are no winners in divorce, and there are no winners in a family that stays together when they think they should have gotten divorced.
No, there are no winners, but when you have a culture which no longer values parenting, which I think is a huge disaster we're facing now. I mean, why would we have maybe 30% of our kids on psych drugs?
I know. Let's talk more about this medication madness with you, Peter, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Peter Bregan. We'll take calls with Peter next hour. Peter, what was it that you saw when you started writing books about talking back to Prozac, medication madness? What were the things you saw as a psychiatrist?
Well, it was really quite amazing to me when I started to look inside the drug companies, George. That was the shock of my lifetime. I began to look at details about how Prozac got approved. And it was astonishing. There was a collaboration between the FDA and the drug company Eli Lilly to fake it when they couldn't actually prove that Prozac was useful.
Jeez.
One thing the drug company did, for example, was they found very quickly that people on Prozac were getting agitated, anxious, aggressive, some were becoming psychotic. And so they illegally started putting their patients on tranquilizers, addictive drugs like Valium and Xanax and sleeping pills, and didn't tell the FDA. When it came time to approve Prozac, the only studies where the patients showed marginal improvement, that's all they showed, statistically marginal improvement, were the ones where they were getting the addictive drugs. So the FDA forgave them for being illegal and putting in these drugs and approved it. And then when it turned out that we were getting a lot of violence and suicide on the drug, the FDA started having secret meetings with Eli Lilly in early morning hours before the government opened so that nobody would see they were meeting together. When Eli Lilly employees around the world started getting reports in from doctors that patients were killing themselves, they were told by Eli Lilly to take a term like suicide and change the reporting term into no drug effect or emotional instability. Mm-hmm. So I think what happened to me when I first started looking at what I thought were going to be scientific problems inside Eli Lilly, and what I found was that this systematic negligent behavior on the part of these drug companies. And, of course, since I was the cutting edge, and since then, you know, they've been paying billions of dollars, many of these companies, to the Attorney General of the United States, you know, for their various malfeasances. But so they pay $2 billion even. Well, they might make $4 billion
That's
in one
right.
year.
It's no money to them, is it?
It bothers them a little, but when the settlements are made and it turns out to be $2 billion, the stock goes up. So it isn't bothering them too much. So I think the biggest thing for me was the disillusionment that I experienced. The first big trial we had on Prozac was fixed by both sides, by the attorneys that brought the suit against the drug companies, fixed the trial with the drug companies to make the drug companies win. I was the medical expert looking at all of this. And
why would the other side do that?
Because they were guaranteed a huge amount of money for doing it. The attorney.
Basically bought
all the people who brought the suit.
Amazing.
And finally, the verdict, I was actually so frustrated because I didn't at first know what was going on. Ginger said, hey, the trial's fixed, but I didn't know what was going on. So I'm actually trying to testify while the attorney who's supposed to be helping me testify is interfering with me in the courtroom. It was so bizarre. But finally, the judge realized afterward that the trial had been fixed, and he changed the verdict. You know, he threw out the courtroom verdict and called it a settlement with prejudice against Eli Lilly.
Really?
But it was never covered in the press. The only thing the press covered, this is back in the mid-1990s, the press covered the initial victory, which was a 9-3 vote, one more vote on my side, and it would have been a hung jury.
Peter,
I can't say on our side because my side wasn't our side.
Some people, when we take calls next hour, will tell you that they're on antidepressants and they work for them. What do you say to that?
Well, you really have to think about what does work mean for you. If you've been on these drugs for 5 or 10 years, what does it mean when you say they work? Do you actually have a full, rich life? You have a good love life? You're enjoying your children, your grandchildren? You're retired and playing golf or doing what you love? Are you committed to changing humanity? Whatever it is that you believe in. Or are you kind of trudging along with a gradually eroding quality of life that you're barely perceiving? Because that's often what happens. I call that medication spellbinding. I describe that in my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, that people don't even know that they are gradually losing their quality of life on these drugs. We do know that the disability ranks in America for children and adults are being swelled as a result of people on the psychiatric drugs gradually eroding motivation and a sense of investment and engagement in life. And most people who think that the drugs are helping them think that when they come off the drug, they get worse, and therefore they need the drug. But it's no different than trying to quit smoking or trying to quit drinking alcohol. You go through withdrawal from psychiatric drugs. My colleagues don't want to admit it very often, but any psychoactive substance changes your brain, and you're going to have an exposed brain when you stop the drug. And what folks need to know is that instead of their doctor doubling their dose when they tried to stop and they got in trouble, the doctor should have said, "You're having withdrawal. We went too fast. We have to go slow. We have to talk with the family and get mute support for you and a lot of help for you, because coming off psychiatric drugs is very difficult and very dangerous, especially if you've been on them for several years and especially when you're taking multiple drugs." But most folks out there have no idea what's going on.
And you do not recommend that people get off these drugs on their own, do you?
No, it's a very high risk, especially if you're on more than one drug, and especially even on one drug for several years, because your own judgment gets impaired by the drugs. These drugs, George, are not fixing biochemical imbalances. That was a PR campaign that no real neuroscientist believes. There are no biochemical imbalances that we know of in the brains of people who are depressed or anxious or upset or having tough times in life. But every time you take a psychoactive substance, whether it's a cigarette or alcohol or marijuana or a psychiatric drug, it is disrupting your biochemical imbalances. And it makes it hard for you then to judge what's happening. So to come off psychiatric drugs, I recommend a very whole family approach. Hopefully you have some folks, or at least one, who can help monitor you, and I recommend people get a therapist to help them. And most psychiatrists will get mad if you ask to come off psychiatric drugs. So, and literally, they'll get mad. It's really a misfortune. They don't know what to do with a patient who says, I want to come off my drugs. It's like asking a carpenter to take down his building. You know, they don't know what to do. They just know how to hit the nails. So what you really need is maybe to go to your pediatrician for your child, or more like your family doctor, your nurse practitioner, somebody who might be more flexible but can prescribe and help you come off the drugs.
Peter, in your career, have your colleagues agreed with you, or have they gone after you? What's it been like?
Imagine the worst possible whistleblower movie, and then increase it a little bit here and there. I believe, George, that the only reason I'm alive is that something greater than me wants me to do this work. Because I've been through every conceivable thing you can imagine going up against. In the beginning, I was the only one, virtually the only medical expert. I was the only medical expert going up against them. And the threats and the actual, I don't want to get into too much detail, but pretty terrifying stuff. Now I joke. I say, "Hey, listen, do me in. It's euthanasia now. It's too late, guys. My work is out there. I've had the impact." And besides, my books will sell better. So, the fear is gone of that now. But it was very terrifying when I was young, George. I really think that what I do is I'm acting under orders that aren't exactly my own sometimes. But I think that many people feel that way. I'll bet sometimes you feel that way when you're working so hard on the show and being there at Christmas and New Year's that you're doing it for something just greater than yourself.
Oh, no question. No question. That's what keeps us going, Peter.
It's what keeps us going. And then, then Ginger came into my life 30 years ago, and we became partners in this work, and that's been a huge, huge difference. I really believe in love, and I always want to let folks know out there, that your millions of listeners, that if you decide to become a source of love, that if you decide that you're going to find that source in yourself and just start radiating caring and empathy and love toward people, that you won't be alone, that you'll find people, because it's just so needed out there that as you decide that's how you want to be, and you start to try to let go of the anger and all the hurt and the resentments, and decide, no, I want to be positive and caring, give the opportunity to other people to have better lives, make good friendships, improve my family life. Once you begin to move in that direction, the world's a really, really good place. But then there's all this other stuff. You know, I'm fond of saying there's love, and then there's all the junk. And this drugging of our kids and drugging of ourselves with psychiatric drugs and street drugs is is just not the way to go. We need a spiritual path.
Peter, are people born in a depressive state, or is that created by their environment and society?
George, we have known for decades that children become depressed in response to their environment. Going all the way back to World War II, when the psychoanalysts and the psychologists in Great Britain first decided that the best thing for the children and the families that were being bombarded in London was to send the children out into the countryside, you know, to nice families to live away from the war. They found out that it was better to be with your loving parent in a war zone than to be separated. And then the separated kids would often get depressed. We've known this for a long, long time, that the suffering that children go through, whether it's depression or withdrawal or anxiety, is directly related to their caretakers and their relationships with their caretakers in the first one, two, and three very formative years. There's research on this is overwhelming, but it so contradicts the prevailing government psychiatry pharmaceutical model that kind of research doesn't get funded anymore, but it still goes on by people who are willing, you know, to do it on a shoestring. And there's just no doubt about it. How we raise our children is everything. I just spent 3 days playing with my grandchildren.
Isn't that great?
In Western Mass. Yeah. It's wonderful, but it's exhausting. And it takes so much effort to be even a grandparent for 3 days, let alone what my daughter and
it's a lot of work.
Son-in-law are doing.
It's a lot of work. You know, it's a lot of work as a parent, and then you think, hey, I'm done, and then the little ones pop up again. You know?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And now with the economy going so bad and the world just not being as good as it once was, we end up helping folks more than we expected to. But that's what life is about. Life is about what we give to each other. And it's not about finding the right drug. There isn't any right drug. There's a right spiritual outlook on life, which has to do with deciding that our lives have meaning, that we're going to give to people, that we're going to take risks for things that matter, stuff like that. Good old American stuff.
Great American stuff. Are you glad you're doing what you're doing?
Oh, yes. I'm 78 now. Oh, and by the way, I'm running again. I was playing tag with a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old, great athletes, and I actually ran them down in a tag game.
You won.
So I tagged them. At 78, I did it. I almost fell over.
Passed out, and collapsed. Yeah, be careful.
And my happiness is luck, and some of it's a blessing, but some of it I can look back and say is living more and more by good principles. It's always hard to do, but more and more by good principles.
Peter, when people demonstrate multiple personalities, what creates that? Is there a quirk in the brain? What's doing that?
Well, this is really interesting. I'm actually looking at a book sitting here on my table about partly about that.
I know. I'm remote viewing you. I can see it now.
Yes. We really have a good connection. It's better than I thought, George. Oh, gosh.
By the way, put your shoes back on, would you?
How did you know I kicked my shoes off?
Peter, I'm remote viewing you. I'm telling you this. I'm not kidding.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. I'm on a hard line, folks.
In fairness to you, I'm stopping right now in terms of remote viewing. So don't worry about
it. Well, I trust you. I trust you to have a good look.
Yeah.
When people have been exposed to horrendous sexual, emotional, and physical abuse, especially when there's sexual abuse, and there's also a lot, much more than people realize. And it took me a long time to think this was real. There's a lot of ritualistic, kind of devil worship type of abuse that goes on out there. Well, when you start abusing a child, oh, and a lot of it, George, is between age birth and 3 years. So the kids can't even remember it. But the evidence is that most of it is in the first few years of life. I mean, we're talking about evil criminals beyond imagination. And I've seen this in my practice, and I've read about it. I've talked to other therapists. This is real. Now, what happens to people whose lives have been tortured, often by their own parents, is that they struggle with ways to handle life. I mean, they have out-of-body experiences. They develop friendships in their own minds and hearts with people who are in the media or athletes or entertainers. They seek ways. It's a healthy thing. They seek ways out of the environment they're in. They get lost in stories. They read. And one of the things that people do is they get a sense that they're not really who the person is who's being abused. That's not really me. I'm somebody else. And that can be the beginning of people having a sense that they're more than one person. I think that some therapists make a mistake, and they get caught up in, well, tell me about Jane, and tell me about John, and tell me about all your personalities. And I think that that plays to a tendency from the abuse experience. So I never go in that direction. I always go in the direction of, you're one whole person who's been horribly abused,
mm-hmm.
and so you have these different feelings about yourself. But other therapists really get into this multiple personalities. I'm afraid that a lot of it is the fabrication of the therapist encouraging this very dramatic and exciting evolution. But for sure, George, when you've been horribly abused, you can easily get into feeling like you don't know who you are. First of all, you don't remember the abuse, so right away, you're split off from it.
Interesting take. Peter?
I'm kind of talking a lot here. Am I making sense?
You're making a lot of sense. We're going to take calls with you next hour, okay?
Okay.
Let's do that. Dr. Peter Breggin with us. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Several of his books, Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness. We'll take your calls when we come back. If you got a question or a thought, you're next.